Equilibration in probability is the only form of equilibration that can happen in a closed quantum system that is evolving by unitary evolution. And let me first show with a picture what is that we mean, so that we get some sense. So imagine that we are measuring the expectation value of some observable A, and this is evolving in time. Okay, so I'm gonna plot AT as a function of T. And imagine that this value has a behavior like the one that I'm sketching, which means that if you consider the time average of this value, that I will call A bar, this is the time average over infinite time, okay? So you look at this forever, and you see that the number of points in which A is very different from A bar is a set of measure zero. And the other points that you have some difference, this difference is very small. Okay, so overall, you know, experimentally, right, if this is what you observe, your measurements will, unless you look at the system only at the beginning, by the beginning we know it has not equilibrated. If you start looking at the system after a while, your measurement will always return you something that it is with some error, a bar. And because every time you measure something, you have some fluctuations around the so-called real value, experimentally, you may as well conclude that the real value of a t is a bar for every t, so it has equilibrated. So this is very distinct from saying that the wave function has equilibrated. The wave function keeps evolving forever. And also, A as an operator keeps evolving forever. And even the expectation values, AT, keep evolving forever. However, whatever meaning we give to our observations, we see equilibration. So this is a scenario that we call equilibration in probability. And this is apparently, I mean, we don't see why this should be forbidden. Okay? So this scenario means that these time fluctuations are small. Right? This is what we're saying. So today, we want to understand whether this can actually happen and under which conditions. Okay? So we will prove a beautiful theorem that says something about the time fluctuation. So let me write it in English first. Time fluctuations are upper bounded by something. And then when we understand the nature of this object that is an upper bound for your time fluctuations, then depending on the case, you can conclude whether the time fluctuations are small or large. Okay? So let us set up the stage. So we will call ket phi our initial condition. And in this proof, I will take them to be pure states. All these things can be done again, can be redone for mixed states, but there is no loss actually generality in doing it this way. And then we have a Hamiltonian that we take to be non-degenerate. I'm writing in its spectral resolution. So non-degenerate. Where, what are these? These are the projectors onto the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. They are rank one projectors, which means it's not degenerate. Okay. And time evolution generated by this Hamiltonian is, of course, this. Where, okay, by phi, I mean the density matrix of my initial state. Just phi. Okay. So let's write what this is. This is the sum over n and n prime. And we have phi n n prime e to the minus I e n minus e n prime t e n prime. Similarly, the time evolution of this expectation value is given by the trace of A in phi t, right? So you just plug this expression in there. And one thing that we would like to understand is what is this A bar. So first of all, let me give a definition. For every x, no matter what it is, operator, state, number, I will define x bar as this. The limit for t going to infinity of 1 over t integral between 0 and capital T of xt dt. Okay. So you see that A bar is the bar. Okay, so this is this type of tricks, we will use them all the time. Is the bar of this. But now, averaging, whether it's over time or over any ensemble, is a linear operation, right? Because it's an integral anyway. And expectations values, you know, trace of operators in states, these are linear operations. So I can write this as the trace of A in phi bar. Which means this would be the sum over a n n phi bar n n. In the basis of A. Okay, so we would like to understand what is phi bar, right? To know what is A bar, we need to understand what is phi bar.
Sorry, here this phi and phi is matrix, right?
Sure, yeah.
Phi m.
Sorry, I don't understand your question.
How can you label a matrix by one index?
These are the matrix elements.
Yes.
Yeah.
What's the index on 5 bar?
N. Yeah,
it has two n's.
Oh, and also.
In the basis of A.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so let's compute 5 bar. Okay. So 5 bar is, so I have to take the bar of this. So it is n prime, phi n prime. Let me write it like this. Do you agree? Remember, by bar, I mean doing this integral. So let's do this integral. What do you think it is? So you all have done at some point in calculus one the integral of sine and cosine, right? So you see that when n is equal to n prime, then this is actually a constant. So it just gives me 1. And when n is different from n prime, this average is some finite number. Because remember the just the integral between 0 and some at some t would be a finite number. However, this finite number is getting divided by capital T, and then I'm taking the limit of capital T going to infinity. So you see that would be 0. Okay. So you agree that this is nothing else but delta n prime, which means that this is the sum of just n, phi n, phi n n, en, en. Okay. So now that we know, that, as you can see, the time average of phi are just the diagonal elements of phi in the energy basis. So you may as well write this thing in the energy basis, the same thing. Okay. Actually, let's write it. You know, this is obvious, but maybe it is an illuminating picture as a matrix. This is actually 5, 1, 1, 5, n, and zeros. Right? It's a diagonal matrix. And so what are these objects here? So if your initial state phi was something like this, alpha n e n, right? I can expand it in a basis of the Hamiltonian. Then these matrix elements, so you know, it's okay, let me do it carefully. Then this is the sum over n prime, alpha n, alpha star n, en, en prime. This is what I would call phi n prime, right? This is what I have here. Are the matrix elements of the density matrix. Which means that what I call the phi nn is alpha n modulus square. So it's the population or probability of phi in En. So it's the probability that our initial state has energy En. So you see, these objects here are this probability. Or they're called also populations. You see? And this object can be written also in another way, which is this. Remember what is capital pi n is this projector. So what happens if I take my initial state and I sandwich it between two projectors? What do I get? Okay, so the projector is this, right? This is what I'm doing here. This is this. This is phi nn, and then I'm left with this projector, which is this, right? So you see that this is equal to this. Okay. This operation on phi that, you know, takes phi and sandwiches between the projectors is called defacing operator. So this is a definition. And as you can see, the effect that it has, that if it takes phi and in the basis of this operator, which defines the projectors, defaces it. It just erases the off-diagonal elements. So we discovered something very general, that infinite time, and this is true actually for every operator, not just for the density matrix. Because here the fact that this was a density matrix played no specific role. So that infinite time average we discovered is a defacing operator. So, because it's erasing these things. Now, question that I will put as a remark, and I want you to try to answer me. Is dH an effect of time evolution? So the question is, am I saying that if I evolve the state for a long time, this is the same thing as operating dH over phi? Or I'm not saying that. What is that I'm saying? So first of all, am I saying that or not? Okay, so let's see. Is this state pure or mixed? Here. What about this state? It's mixed. So can time evolution transform a pure state in a mixed state? No. Okay. So I'm not saying, so no. I'm not saying that time evolution is producing this state. I'm saying that if I average over all the states produced by time evolution, I get these states. So averaging is not a unitary operation. Okay. So time evolution is not averaging anything. I'm just computing the time average because it's a mathematical operation that I can compute. Because remember, my goal is to compute the time fluctuations. Okay. And the time fluctuations, now I can write it here, are A at the time t minus A bar squared average over time. So because this is the object that I want to compute, right? It's telling me what is the average distance between this, between the white curve and the red curve. To compute that, so because if I say that this average distance is small, then we know that we have equilibration in probability. To compute it, I have to compute this time averages, right? So this is something that I need to compute, but I'm not stating anywhere that time evolution is producing this effect. Okay. Let me see if I have another remark here that I want to make. Ah, yes. Second remark. Question. Is dH phi a steady state or not? What does it mean that it's steady? What does it mean?
Doesn't evolve in time.
That doesn't involve in time. Very good. And this happens if and only if?
To meet H.
Okay. And now let's look at it. Does the H phi commute with H or not? It's this one. Yeah, I will not proceed if you don't tell me.
Does.
Hmm? Yeah, why?
Because it's written in terms of projectors in the basis of eigenstates.
Yeah, or in other words, as you see, said a diagonal matrix in the same basis. Right? So it commutes. Okay, so DHF, yes, is a steady state because dH phi H commute. And this is actually, you know, a very general property in linear algebra. So imagine that I had some other basis B, strictly speaking, B are the projectors onto some basis. Let me call it these objects. Then it would be true that if I have any operator that is diagonal in this basis, and with some abuse of notation that should be clear, I will call the associated defacing operator DB. Because in the end, the defacing operator is not caring about the matrix element, it's just caring about the projectors. Then DBXB would commute. So this is a useful trick. Okay. So now that we know what is phi bar, this means we know what is A bar, right? This is just that thing over there. And now we're ready to compute the time fluctuations. Okay, so let's do that. So okay, so let's prove this theorem. And the hypotheses for this theorem are that H obeys the non-resonance condition which means that on top of being non-degenerate, let me remind you, non-degenerate means that this happens if and only if J is equal to K. But the non-resonance condition is stronger. It says that, let me see what index I used. If EJ minus EK is equal to EN minus EM. So if there is some gap that is equal to some other gap, non-resonance means, oh, it's actually not another gap. That is, if J equal N and K is equal N. So these are our hypotheses. So there is no degeneracy and non-degenerate gaps in the Hamiltonian. Before we proceed, do you feel that this is a very strong condition or a very weak condition or some condition on your Hamiltonian? What is your feeling about this? Like I'm asking something very strong. Like, you know, this is a very special type of Hamiltonians that, you know, you have all these gaps. Imagine you have an Hamiltonian on a 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. So there are 2 to the n levels. Imagine n is 10 to the 23. So there are 2 to the 10 to the 23 levels. And I'm asking that no such two levels are the same, and no such two gaps in all these levels are the same. What do you feel? Is this very likely or very unlikely? Yeah, so just first give me your gut feeling, and then we try to argue about that. Huh?
I think it's very strong as a condition.
Okay, you think it is very strong. And let's try to argue about that. Okay? So, if we are making a statement about the likelihood of this thing, it means that we are making a statement of measure, right? Probability and likelihood are a measure. So this means that in the space of all the Hamiltonians, we are trying to understand how likely it is to have a Hamiltonian that respects these conditions. When you say, oh, this is very strong, means, oh, you know, it couldn't be very likely. And let's test this feeling, okay? So imagine that I do take an Hamiltonian of those that you think are likely, those that do have some degeneracy in the gaps or in the spectrum itself. Okay? So you have this Hamiltonian, it has all these levels, and these levels, at some point, somewhere, there is a degeneracy, or possibly more than one. Right? Because you're saying, oh, this is what is likely. Then imagine that I perturb this Hamiltonian with a random operator V. It's just a small perturbation. And V is a random operator. So if I perturb with a random operator, so I'm starting with this Hamiltonian, this means that I'm exploring in my measure theory, some ball in the space of Hamiltonian, some balls of a radius that, let me be sloppy now, is like epsilon, right? Okay. So, you know, we can argue about what happens in this ball. So if I perturb the Hamiltonian with the random operator, what happens to the degeneracies?
It's
the split. So this is a special point. Typically, they have no degenerates. You see? So in fact, it's the other way around. The condition of being, of having some degeneracy is very strong. And it is, as I just showed you, very fine-tuned. Any random perturbation will lift the degeneracy, unless, you know perturbation theory, unless unless it respects some symmetry, which is the same symmetry that was responsible for the degeneracy in the first place. Now you see, symmetry is something exact. It's fine-tuned. If an operator does not commute with another operator, doesn't have that symmetry, no, then it would be fun to do a theory of being quasi-symmetry, which means that the norm of this commutator is small. But that's another story. But a symmetry and a degeneracy, it's exact.
Yeah, but I think we need to consider the approximate symmetry here because we are considering the probability. So if anything is small, we also need to consider.
Wonderful. So all I'm asking to prove my theorem is that there is no exact resonance.
Only exact.
So I'm only asking that it's not exact. So I want to come exactly your direction. That it's fine if there are some gaps that are very small.
Okay.
I'm just excluding the exact case of exact symmetry because exact symmetry is rare and it's fine-tuned. Okay, cool. So now we know that this is very weak, right? This is a very weak condition. So I'm not losing much generality. It means that for the overwhelming majority of the Hamiltonians that I can think of, whatever I'm going to prove, it will hold. Okay. So theorem, the thing that I want to prove, is that the temporal fluctuations are upper bounded by the product of two numbers. One of these numbers depends on the operator, and it is the norm of the operator squared. Let me put a P here. I will explain in a second what I mean. For the time being, it's just the norm of the operator square. This P that I'm putting there makes the bound a bit tighter. So even without P, this is true. Times the trace of phi bar square. Now let's look at phi bar. Phi bar is this object, right? Are the populations. Remember, what I call pi k is phi kk, which is modulus square of alpha k, right? Are my populations in the basis of the Hamiltonian. And as we argued, now this state is not pure. How much is not pure? How do you know how pure is a state? Or how impure is a state? You take the sum of the squares of these eigenvalues. It's called purity, right? And it is equal to the trace of this operator square. Oh, so this is the purity of the completely defaced state. So, okay, at the end of the theorem, in the meanwhile, start thinking under which conditions this upper bound is a very small number, because this is what we are interested in. Okay? But now let's prove it. Okay. So first of all, let me define this state, phi tilde of t, which is just phi t minus phi bar. So can you help me comment about what state is this? The difference between the state at the time t and its time average, what is it?
Fluctuation of phase.
Now, fluctuations must be the square of some difference, right? So look at the expressions for phi t up there and phi bar. Just look at it. Yes, it's the off diagonal part of phi t, because phi bar is the diagonal part of phi t, the one that is not evolving in time. So because I'm concerned with the fluctuations, I'm only interested in what happens in the part that is actually evolving in time. So let me write this, and you see that I just need to copy that expression. But now it's the off diagonal part, so let me just write it. I don't need this here. This is purity of phi bar. Okay. Do you agree this is phi tilde? Obviously. Oh, I want to say something else. Where did I write it? Yeah, I can say it now. Obviously, the diagonal part of phi tilde t is
zero.
Right? Because phi tilde is defined as some operator minus its diagonal. Okay. And therefore, so this is all very too simple, but you know, you have simple things and you plug them in without thinking of it too much. Its trace is zero. It's a traceless operator. Okay. Now, you know, it can happen, let me write here, that your initial state, right, that has some populations, then it has some off diagonal elements, okay? But it could happen that these levels are not populated at all. Okay, so that it is different from zero only in this subspace that I call H plus. So in other words, H plus, to be mathematically correct, is the support of phi. Okay. So now I want to do everything only in the actual Hilbert space, which is a subspace of the full Hilbert space. Because it's the only one in which something is going on. If your initial state has no support in some component of the Hilbert space, then it will not evolve in those eigenstates, right? time evolution is just rotations, okay? So if you do not have a component in one of these vectors, it's not like these rotations will bring you there. Because it's unitary, right? It's not like a projection or worse. You know, a projection makes you lose components. But definitely, you cannot gain components somewhere else. Okay, so in H plus, so this is called the effective Hilbert space, I would like to know what is the norm of the operator A. Just in H plus. And I will call it delta A. Oh, okay. It is just the max over all these expectation values with psi in H plus minus the mean of all these expectation values with psi in H plus. Right? This is the definition of the operator norm. And I will call this thing A max minus A min. So it's the difference of these two numbers. So typically, one says, oh, you know, the operator norm is the largest eigenvalue because one shifts the operator of the minimum so that the smallest eigenvalue is zero. In fact, let me do that. Let me call A tilde the operator A minus A min times the identity. So now you see that the norm of this guy
this phi is arbitrary operator.
A is an arbitrary operator.
I mean phi. Phi is an arbitrary vector, not our phi t.
No. It's any vector in H plus.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not our density matrix.
And I'm maximizing over all the possible vectors that are there. But what I'm saying is that our phi t lives in H plus.
Yes.
Because it's the support. And the time evolution conserves the support. Okay. So therefore, if I take the expectation value of H tilde of A tilde for a psi that lives in H plus, this is greater than zero. That's why I did this shift, and this is smaller of delta A. Okay. So let's remember that. Okay, so now we are ready to, let me see if I want to use this part of, let me use it. Let's see if I can make it fit. Let's compute our delta A squared. Okay? So it is, as we said, the average of the square of the difference between AT and A bar. And this is the trace of A in phi T minus the trace of A in phi bar. Let me write this. We agree that these are the temporal fluctuations. Okay. Oh, but this is just the trace of A in phi tilde t. Sorry, this is phi t squared, right? Because this is my definition of phi tilde. Okay. Now remember that this is a traceless operator.
Yes.
Okay. So this means that if I add to A any operator that is diagonal, that doesn't make a difference. Because this is a traceless operator, right? This is what we wrote here. So if I add to A any operator that is diagonal, trace is linear, right? So when I take the trace of this diagonal operator in phi tilde, I will get zero. Do you agree? Okay. So I can shift A of anything I want. So I may as well put a tilde here. The contribution of A mean times the identity is zero. Okay. So I can put a tilde there. You agree? Okay. Good. So let's write it. Let's expand this thing. So this will be equal to A tilde JK phi KJ, and I'm summing over J and K, but remember J is different from K, right? It is here. You see, phi tilde has only the off-diagonal elements, and then I have A tilde, I'm taking the square, so I have to do it twice. And this is M different from N. And now I have E to the I, EJ minus CK plus EM minus EN T. And now I have to take the bar. And the bar lives here. So this is equal to this. Are you with me? You agree this is what we have? Everyone cool? Okay. Now let's take this time average. And now remember, you see now here we have the gaps. That's why I asked for this. So you see that the only way that you get something different from zero is that this gap is equal to n minus n. But then in that case, it must be that j is equal to n and k is equal to n. So this is just delta jm delta km. Okay. So let's insert that. So we have here, so j and k get absorbed. We have just the sum of m different from n. And now we have a tilde mn phi n m. And again, a tilde mn phi n m. Oh, and this is equal, obviously, to the sum of n different from m of, look at this and this. These are conjugate complex numbers. So this is a tilde mn modulus square, and this is phi mn modulus square. And I'm summing on over all the m different from n's. Now, what happens if I add to this the diagonal part? I get an upper bound. So there is no harm in doing that because we want to find upper bounds. So, you know, I can drop this and just put lesser than equal here. Do you agree? I'm just summing some positive number. You see, I cannot do it at this level because these are complex numbers. You know, adding a complex number, you don't get an upper bound. But now these are positive numbers. So that's why I get an upper bound. But luckily, I got positive number because this is what my averaging did.
Sorry, here AM and double AM square is also a common. Why can't you take a norm of?
I know. Okay, so this is AMN. Yeah. I think that they are like this. So in fact, it's the other ones that touch. Okay. See, M. This is N M. Okay. Okay. Now, what I can use is the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. And actually, the way the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality implies what I'm going to write is that there is a little subtlety. Okay, you will find it as an exercise in the notes. Okay, but the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality does hold, so this is smaller than A. Okay, so I want to use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality here. I want to write it at fmn, let me write it here, at phi mn square is smaller or equal than phi mm times phi nn. Okay? So now, if I do re-expand this, so I rewrite it in this way, and I use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, then here we'll have mn phi nn. This is the tilde, A tilde NM, yeah, phi MM. Okay. So re-expand this part, so you get this and this. I re-expand this part, you get this and this, then you use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Okay, and you see that, okay, so let me write it explicitly. And then I'm just checking, okay, here I had expanded it again, so I have to put them back, right? Okay, so let me write it explicitly. So this is, let me write it like this, then I will explain. Why I can write this? Why I can pull the phi bar inside this? Oh, because we know that phi bar is diagonal in this basis with this eigenvalue. Remember, phi bar is the diagonal matrix in the basis of En, and it has as eigenvalues phi n. So that's why I can write that. And now, here, this sum, I can use the resolution of the identity.
Okay.
So this becomes the sum over M of EM A tilde phi bar EN, AN, sorry, square is the square here. Okay. So, which is the trace of A tilde phi bar square. And this is furtherly upper bound, and if you, I'm running out of time, this can, you can actually do it as an exercise. It's simple linear algebra. You will find the details in the notes by the norm square of a p of a tilde times this thing, and this norm square. So, okay, so let me do that. Let me do this first. Let me take some. Okay, imagine that P plus is the projector onto H plus. Then what happens if I take P plus phi bar P plus? What do you think I get?
Phi bar
again. Phi bar lives in H plus. Okay. So this means that here I can put these projectors, right? I'm doing this because it's actually instructive, because these are other tricks. Okay, you agree I can do that? Now inside the trace, I can take the P here. So now this becomes the trace of AP. I define AP, A projected on that space, phi bar square.
It's trace over square or? Square of trace.
Okay. And now, and this is an exercise, and let me pull this up. So let me rewrite. So we are saying that delta I square is smaller or equal than the trace of A tilde P phi bar square, right? Now exercise, you will find it in the notes, but it's not very hard. This is upper bounded by the norm of A in H plus, I'm done, times the rest square. Times the rest. Which concludes the proof. That's what I wanted to prove. You see? That's what I wanted to prove. Okay, so now let's, in these 2 minutes, let's discuss the meaning of this. Okay. So the time fluctuations are upper bounded by this number times this number. Okay. Now let's consider the case that the operator whose expectation value we are looking at is a as it should, a local operator. Then this norm will not scale with the dimension of the Hilbert space, will not scale with the number of bodies that you have. That's the definition of local, right? It will be upper bounded by a number times R, where R is the volume of my operator. You agree? So this is a number of order one in the dimension of the Hilbert space. Now let's look at this. The trace of phi bar square is the purity of phi bar, right? Is the sum of these guys. When is this object small? So we know that this number is always smaller than what? One. It's always greater or equal to what? One over the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay. So it can be very small, because in the, you know, in the thermodynamic limit, this is is, for instance, if you have 10 to the 23 spins, it's 2 to the 10 to the 23. But what does it mean? What does it mean to reach this lower bound? When does that happen? When all the p's are the same, right? But what if not all the p's are the same, but they are at least all of them different from zero? What do you get? Imagine it is, you know, it is full rank, and they are, and the distribution is not very peaked. You know, it's a bit flat. That's all the same means this. But if it is a bit flat, so it is not very, very narrow, this still scales like 1 over the h. So here you have what happens, that the time, if your initial state has components on many states in the Hilbert space, then the time fluctuations are upper bounded by 1 over the dimension of the Hilbert space. Or in other words, this is also called inverse participation ratio. It's telling you how much weight, how spread is the weight of your state in the Hilbert space. Okay, so you see these are sufficient conditions. If I prepare my initial state in a superposition of many states of the Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian is reasonable, then I'm guaranteed that the time fluctuations are exponentially small. Okay, so this is one scenario in which this happens. This, because this is a sufficient condition, right? I'm not saying it's also a necessary condition. For example, now that you know, you will find this in the notes or later as a homework in part two. That now that you know, so we need a many body system to try this out. But, oh, okay, we have an hour at two, so I will talk about this example in the next hour.